Day 4. April retreat. April Fool's retreat. During a work period at his monastery, Baizhang Huihai was ploughing the ground. A monastic heard the sound of the drum ending the work period. At that moment he held up his hoe, burst into laughter, and went back to the monastery. Baizhang said, "Wonderful! This is Avalokiteshvara entering the gate of essential nature. This is the figure of compassion entering the gate of essential nature." Okay. So we've been looking at the story and about the kind of naturalness of our practice, and the bell goes at the end of the work period, just feeling wonderful, waving your hoe about, laughing. And the teacher, seeing this in the field, and just making him happy. Wonderful. Great figure of compassion entering the gate of essential nature. I mean, pretty wordy, really. Full of kind of Zen jargon. But it's very likely that those kind of spiritually correct words were added later. Oh, this is Avalokiteshvara entering the gate of essential nature. I can't imagine any Zen teacher I know saying that in the middle of a field, his boots full of mud. But if we just bracket that, what is there is just his enjoying of the monk's spontaneity, if you like. Just his joy at seeing somebody just going for it. And there's a phrase in it, this is one of the books, this True Dharma Eye, it's got little commentaries on, that the one phrase in the commentary about Baizhang's response is, "When lightning strikes the mountain, thunder rolls through the valley." When lightning strikes the mountain, thunder rolls through the valley. So you see somebody just sort of getting it, like the monk, just being spontaneous and natural and full of life. And you respond to that, just naturally. Wonderful. Wonderful. When lightning strikes the mountain, thunder rolls through the valley. It's just wonderful. Wonderful phrase. The kind of infectiousness of this life. And just as we respond with sadness when someone is unhappy, so when someone is joyful, we respond in that way. It's part of our natural interconnectedness. Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing. It's just the natural way we live. It's not anything special. It's not Zen or non-dual or holy or essential nature or any of that. It's just how it is. And there's a kind of sense there of going below the radar of how practice should be, into just a sort of sniffing out what is actually happening here in this life. I tell a joke, you laugh or groan. Like Day Gak, Zen Master Day Gak tells these terrible sort of, there's a word for them, like one horse barroom jokes. Yeah. Cowboy walks into the barroom and he actually has a little book of these and he kind of looks, and everybody knows that the most appalling joke's coming, and in concert we all go, oh, and he's thrilled to bits. Anyway, that's another matter. But it's also thunder rolling through the mountain. Oh, God. Okay. But all the time in this practice, there's this overlay, if you like, of kind of Buddhist teachings or spiritual whodunits and magazine advice on how to live this life. And all of it's important in its own way. All of it's lovely and beautiful and necessary at a certain point. But somehow, if we can just get under it, it's like getting under the carpet. And we've got to be very slippery to get in there, make ourselves very thin, under the carpet, and there all sorts of life's going on. And if we get stuck in this kind of Zen teaching stuff, or non-dual teaching, or Buddhist, or whatever, it's often so easy to miss the kind of naturalness, the flow, the swing of it, you know. There's two things come to mind. One was a number of years ago, we tried holding sort of combined practices, a bit like they do at the meditation centers, like BRC and Bodhikaya and so on, Dharmagiri, to some extent, I think, where you get kind of linked meditation, psychology, meditation, painting, meditation, and rocket building, and so on. We had a thing here where someone was teaching us about posture and how to walk properly, how to balance, and everyone's on the lawn here where there are no dobukis, sort of walking slowly, balancing, having poise, just really concentrating. And at that moment the men rode back from the felt, they'd been counting the sheep, and they galloped past on their horses, just floating on the backs of these animals. And then they passed. Just absolutely embodying everything that that retreat was about. And inside, everyone was fiercely balancing, concentrating. Whoa, nearly getting it. Lost it. Okay. I mean, I was one of them. I just remember looking up and just saw this beautiful figure, just so at ease with this animal. And there I was going, I have another story about that that I remember from long ago. In England, in the UK, I was doing Tibetan practice. That's where I started. And we had a sort of mindfulness weekend, I think. Anyway, somewhere near Saffron Walden, that means anything. Anyway, Tibetans always are very good at getting really great properties. They had bought this old castle. They're just like the Quakers. They seem to have endless resorts, and the Zen people were sort of in barracks and sort of converted toilets and so on. And anyway, we had this beautiful, beautiful house, and we spent most of the time sort of fixing it up, of course, inevitably. And we had a teacher come, and he was going to mindfulness and had recently discovered Tibetan text on Indian mindfulness and so on. They were giving very erudite things, and we'd have these breaks, and then there would be tea. There was always tea.
Yeah.
As you know, there's no tea in the Zen retreats. But had tea, and everyone was outside practicing their mindful walking. I don't know if some of you have done this, of course, you know, like, but there's a certain form of mindful walking which is very slow. It's just one half a foot in front of the other, rolling your feet, feeling the grass or the floorboards, very focused, very slow. And everyone was a bit like they do here, sort of outside in the grass during after tea, and doing this very slow, ultra slow walk. And a friend of mine was had his tea, and he was lying down on the grass. He fell asleep with his hands out like this. He sighed, "I missed you." And I remember watching as a very earnest man came doing his mindful walking, and he walked across the grass over these outstretched fingers and just walked straight over them, just really mindfully, you know. And off he went. My friend woke up. Maybe he's telling the story somewhere. But it was just a wonderful, just sort of summed up everything I felt about my struggles in mindfulness practice. You can use it as a kind of a weapon, you know. You even say things to yourself. You put your foot down, heel down, down, grass, trail down, down, finger, finger, hand, nose. I'm just like that too, so I'm not... It's just one of the sort of oddities of this practice. Not just this practice, any practice. New diet, a new help yourself, self-development course, whatever it is. One one feels the pain of this life. One wants to really do it better, so we go for it. It's part of our great effort in a way. It's part of just wanting to do things so well that we cure all the pain and suffering and hesitations and doubts of our life. But together with that, we kind of lose our naturalness, we lose our spontaneity, we lose our sense of being part of this absurd, tragic situation that we're living in. And we kind of tighten and attach around those things we really feel desperate about. And Dharma teachings is one of those things. It's like relationship advice, you know. Get lots of relationship advice. You get so much time trying to do it right that it all goes wrong. Mm. You know. There's, I'm just trying to think where my mind is heading now. I'm trying to see if I can find it. I spent the after breakfast period discussing long drops with the farm men. There's a good koan in there, but anyway, another day. When lightning strikes the mountain, thunder rolls through the valley. In another famous Zen story, which some of you will know, the Buddha goes to Vulture Peak to give his first sermon. You know the story. And everybody comes, assembles, he's the new guru in the block. He's not even 30, I think, at the time, is that right? People come to see what wisdom he had to impart. Put flowers in front of him, sit there waiting. And he picks up a flower, holds it up. And puts it down again. And he leaves. That's the Zen version of the Buddha's first sermon. Just a fantastic story. Moving, moving. And everybody just looks. Except for one man at the back. His name was Mahakashyapa. Who saw the flower. And he just smiled. When lightning strikes the mountain, thunder rolls through the valley. When you see something and are touched by it, are connected by it, when you really see it with your heart, you naturally respond. Great joy. When somebody is sick, you respond naturally with great compassion. Because because you're connected with what's happening. And when in our life we just get under the radar, under the carpet of this life of strong opinions and rights and wrongs and how to do it and how it should be and what the Buddha said and what Jesus said and Abraham said, anybody else said, wife said, husband said, you get under that, it's all something very organic and natural happening. My talking and your listening is like that. It's not about whether I'm saying anything sensible or edifying. It's because it's something we're doing together. Just like that. Bom. Milk is spilt in the kitchen floor. Someone walks past, gets a rag and wipes it up. Very clear, very simple. And retreat practice gives us that opportunity. When we don't have to sort of cope in a world full of opinions and plans and argument. It just gives us an opportunity to sense what we all know to be there. And we don't have to name it. We don't have to say essential principle, essential nature, great principle, or Buddha nature. But if we use those words, how can we use them without being caught in them? Because we use words in our life a lot. We need to. That's part of being human. So the next step is, how do we use them without getting caught? And koan works a bit like that. You're always getting thrown some Zen words or some question. See if you're going to bite the hook. And we all bite the hook. That's why we're here. If we weren't hook biters, we wouldn't need to come on retreat. We could spend our money on fishing or something. Give it to the Ozlers. Much better. So I have a koan for you this morning. We saw a beautiful picture this morning of a grandfather and a baby. Okay. There's a nice question. Well, here's one question to start. Is that baby a Zen master or not? Okay. There are more questions to come. We'll save them for someone in this room. Okay. That bears a baby. Is he a Zen master or not? Okay. Thank you for listening. Oh yes, let's sit for a minute. Sorry, let's just sit for a minute.